Welcome, listener, to episode 12 of the Antigen Internet Radio Show on Shipful of Bombs, Southend-on-Sea's premier internet-only radio station. My name is Jason, and I invite you to join me for an hour of solemn music and quiet reflection as we interrupt our scheduled programming to remember one of the 180,000 people who've died in the UK this year, a person whose death was important enough to postpone the final of MasterChef, a man worshipped as a god and revered by subjects of the Commonwealth as the straight-talking royal with a unique sense of humour, the prince formerly known as Prince Philippos Andreou Schleswig-Holstein-Sonderburg-Glücksberg, but known to us by his made-up English name, Prince Philip Mountbatten, the Duke of Edinburgh. Yes, tonight's show is a royal special in which we take a break from banging on about the hypocrisy of the government and the Tory press to pay tribute to the people's prince. And we stand shoulder to shoulder with the proud, patriotic, Brexit-loving folk of the Essex coast to celebrate the life of a penniless refugee who won our hearts by coming over here, grooming a 13-year-old girl, and living most of his adult life on handouts from the state. A father of four who told the German press his ambition in death was to be reincarnated as a deadly virus to contribute something to solving overpopulation. A man who did indeed contribute something to solving overpopulation by dying on the 9th of April. That was Fiery Gun Hand by Cardiacs from the Sing to God album, released in 1996. And that was dedicated to the memory of bandleader Tim Smith, who died in July 2020 after a long illness. We start tonight's story with the birth of Prince Philippos, born into the Greek and Danish royal family on the island of Corfu in 1921. He arrived in the UK from France, aged 7, following his family's flight from Greece to Italy in the immediate aftermath of the military coup in 1922. Fortunately for Philippos, scientists have heeded the warning in last month's podcast about the danger of sending serial bully Priti Patel back in time, and she was not there in 1928 to prevent the chain of events that led to the Greek prince becoming part of our royal family. Her recent proposals for faster and fairer asylum laws, had they been in place at the time, would have forced young Philippos to seek asylum in the first safe country he arrived at. He would have grown up in Italy instead of the UK, and might have fought against Britain in the Second World War as a naval officer in the Mediterranean. Imagine how different things would have been in this weird parallel universe if Priti Patel had been able to tinker with the timeline. King Edward VIII could have become a Nazi sympathiser advocating an alliance with Hitler. Three of Prince Philip's sisters might have married prominent Nazi officers. His least racist grandson might have been photographed attending a party in a Gestapo uniform. And the House of Windsor could even now be in turmoil over the existential threat of contaminating the genetic purity of the royal bloodline with a mixed-race commoner. Luckily for the popular image of the royal family, none of that crazy stuff happened. And all because the Home Secretary at the time was the Right Honourable Sir William Joynson Hicks. He may have been a reactionary right-winger who amused colleagues in the House by dressing in a top hat and frock coat, and was described as the most prudish, puritanical and Protestant Home Secretary of the 20th century. And he may have vowed to stem the flood of filth coming across the Channel. But even he had more compassion for refugees than Priti Patel. Oscillations from Silver Apples by Silver Apples, released in 1968 and played in memory of synth pioneer Simeon Cox, who died in September last year. Philippos may have been a freeloading refugee who had been driven back into the sea by Priti Patel waving a stick, but he lucked out when at 18 he formed what commentators consider an age-appropriate friendship with his 13-year-old cousin, Princess Elizabeth. Royal biographers are coy about what attracted the penniless prince to the tween-age heiress destined to become the richest person in the UK. But, like many rebellious teenagers, Elizabeth was besotted with this unsuitable older man, finding him even more attractive because her family considered him boorish and uncouth, like all foreigners. Philippos was particularly unpopular with Elizabeth's dad, George No. 6, who told him before he could marry the young princess, he would have to become a decent, God-fearing Englishman and change his name to something everybody could pronounce. It was important he renounced his foul Greekness, because back then in England, married women could not be trusted to have their own nationality. They might be duped into passing on their Britishness to a conniving foreigner in a marriage of convenience. To avoid an influx of impoverished Greeks stealing our women, the 1914 British Nationality and Status of Aliens Act clearly stated, "The wife of an alien shall be deemed to be an alien." It was designed to dissuade British women from taking alien husbands. And they didn't mean cute aliens, like Ewoks. They meant bad aliens, like Orientals or Negroes. So Philippos the Greek became Philip the English by naturalisation in 1946, because otherwise Princess Elizabeth would have become Greek when they tied the knot, and imagine how that would have turned out for the UK. The national dish would have been fried aubergine casserole, corruption in the financial sector would have crippled the economy, causing years of austerity, and politicians would be lining their pockets with public money. Jesus Almost Got Me by Anita Lane, whose death was announced last week. That was taken from her first solo album, Dirty Pearl, which was recorded with Mick Harvey of The Birthday Party and the Bad Seeds and released in 1993. More from her a bit later. In 1947, in what proved to be a busy year, Philip's hard work earned him the title of His Royal Highness, the Dukedom of Edinburgh, the Earldom of Merioneth, and the Barony of Greenwich. But Philip retained his common touch. As reported by the New York Times, he would answer the telephone himself, setting a royal precedent. He would also mix his own drinks, open doors for himself, and even carry his own suitcase. He gave up his job in the Navy in 1952 when he realised he'd be better off on benefits, which he then claimed for the next 69 years, eking out a living on a £359,000 a year pension. Some people see the British monarchy as an expensive waste of money, arguing that the real net cost to the taxpayer could be in the region of £350 million a year. Others, who know their place, constantly point out how hard-working they are, with The Sun proclaiming in January that the Queen carried out 136 online engagements last year, over 130 days, plus two in-person appointments, for which she reluctantly ordered her servants to dress her from the waist down, for the knighting of Captain Sir Tom Moore, and her own official birthday, which apparently counts as work. Few of us would want the Queen's job, having to work 18 weeks a year, making polite conversation with commoners, for what? For £85.9 million and a few perks. £85.9 million might sound like a lot of money, but it wasn't always that much. Until 2017, the royal family had to scrape by on less than half that. But then the Queen asked for a pay rise, so she could do up Buckingham Palace without spending any of her own money. So, in 2017, when the rest of the UK was 7 years into a national austerity programme, the government increased the annual sovereign grant by 178%, from £42.8 million to £76.1 million a year. The grant is now calculated at 25% of the Crown Estate's net profit. And if you're worried that profits dropped last year due to COVID, do not be concerned. The government introduced legislation in 2020 to ensure the sovereign grant can never be reduced when profits from the Crown Estate fall. It can only ever increase or remain the same, even when the royal family is furloughed for a year and barely doing any work. Now, all this might sound like a big fuck you to our hard-working nurses, or to the people who saw their furlough pay drop to 60% last year, or to the 7 out of 10 people on low income who had their application for a £500 self-isolation support payment turned down. But that's because you, my cynical Republican friend, do not understand love of Queen and country. But if being a royal really is a job, rather than a birth privilege, it's obviously a job requiring very few qualifications, beyond emerging from the correct royal vagina and making it into adulthood without being locked in an institution for mental defectives and declared dead by your own family. These low entry requirements, coupled with a lack of formal capability proceedings, may go some way to explaining how Prince Philip managed to keep his job for so many years without being sacked for gross misconduct. Philip was affectionately dubbed the Duke of Hazard, not just because of his dangerous driving and his uncanny ability to evade the law after leaving other road users with life-changing injuries, but for the many times he accidentally revealed what the royal family are really thinking when they have to make polite small talk with foreign dignitaries or working-class riffraff. There are way too many hilarious examples of this for a one-hour radio show. Many of us, I'm sure, remember his classic gaffes, telling a British student during a state visit to China in 1986, "If you stay here much longer, you will go home with slitty eyes." And asking Australian Aboriginal businessman William Brim in 2002, "Do you still throw spears at each other?" But my favourite comment is from 2001, when he told 13-year-old Andrew Adams he was too fat to be an astronaut, because no one likes a fat working class boy with aspirations. For younger listeners, I ought to explain that back then, comments like this were deemed offensive and the Duke was regarded as an embarrassing anachronism. Now, of course, his comments wouldn't be at all controversial, and if you were to criticise them, you would be the person in the wrong for promoting cancel culture. In this more enlightened era, many of the press were happy to attribute his catalogue of creepy innuendo, casual racism and class contempt to straight talking and his unique sense of humour. Or Bants, as we would call it now, if we were in the pub with Lawrence Fox. And so, despite compelling evidence of inappropriate workplace behaviour, Prince Philip kept his job until he was 96, helped by the fact that the royal family's current HR guidance was written in 1700, when child trafficking was still considered a noble profession, and the only way a member of the firm could lose their job is if they disgraced the family by taking a native wife from the colonies. I Found That Essence Rare by Gang of Four from Entertainment, issued in 1979, dedicated to the memory of Andy Gill, who died in February last year. That's also dedicated to my dear friend Rocky, who has an irrational dislike of Gang of Four. Now time for a quick doom scroll through the other news. The timing of the royal death was a disaster for Boris Johnson, who was denied the opportunity to respond to critics of his Brexit bodge, which had left a de facto border between the UK mainland and occupied Ireland. Angry unionists symbolically set fire to a big red bus to make it easy for photoshoppers to score satire points at the expense of Brexiteers. But then Prince Philip died and no one cared. More details emerged of Oily Dave's bid to persuade his pal Rishi to sink £20 billion of our money into failed finance company Greensill Capital to secure what has transpired to be an estimated nine-figure share bonus for the absent father of Brexit. Unfortunately, that sort of money is only available to mates of the government. And Oily Dave paid the price for once calling Boris a greased pig and became one of the few Tory grandees forced to miss out on a COVID cash bonanza. Of course, when David Cameron calls you a greased pig, it's not merely an insult. It's a thinly veiled sexual threat. There was no such disappointment for Matt Hancock and his family. For him, COVID is a gift that keeps on giving. He declared last month that his NHS had awarded private company Topwood Limited a £300,000 contract, and then found out that both he and his sister are shareholders in that company. A government spokesman insisted Mr. Hancock, who said he had a delegated management arrangement for the gifted shares, had acted entirely appropriately. I don't own any shares, so I'm not familiar with technical terms like gifted shares. But I checked online, and apparently it means they are given to someone and not bought with their own money. Times are tough for a lot of businesses, so it's especially nice of someone to give Matt Hancock a 15% stake in their company when it wasn't even his birthday. And then that company gets a six-figure NHS contract. As Boris would say, nothing to see here. Six football clubs were so impressed by the business prospects of a post-Brexit Britain that they decided to join a new European Super League. We didn't discover the revenue implications for the Exchequer, but it was a clear PR catastrophe for anyone who thought that European clubs would be lining up to join a new British Super League after the runaway success of Brexit. Prime Minister's response showed that he recognised this was the biggest national disaster of his premiership, and it prompted his immediate personal intervention. Both he and Oliver Dowden attended an emergency meeting with the heads of the Football Association and Premier League, threatening them with a legislative bomb if the plan wasn't withdrawn. The speed of Boris Johnson's reaction to this sports entertainment emergency confused people who remembered that he missed the first five COBRA meetings about an apocalyptic plague sweeping the planet. But people weren't confused by his pandemic priorities for long, as they were helpfully leaked to the press by an anonymous source, the Chatty Rat.
Walk and cry, kneel and cry,
Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds with a title track from his 1984 album, From Her to Eternity. That track was co-written by Anita Lane. Boris might be a slippery pig who has somehow avoided responsibility for one of the highest COVID death tolls in the world, but he faced criticism last week after it was reported he said he was happy to let the bodies pile high in their thousands, rather than experience the economic inconvenience of a second lockdown. I'm not sure why this was even news. Friends and colleagues tried to distract the media by drawing attention to the Prime Minister's personal plight over the COVID lockdown, living in what his most recent girlfriend Carrie Simmons described as a John Lewis furniture nightmare. If you've read Alan Clark's diaries, you'll be aware that aristocratic Tories love to sneer at people who have to buy their own furniture. It's difficult to imagine the squalor a person would be living in with only £30,000 a year from the government for furniture and decor, but it would explain why Boris always looks like he's been sleeping in a skip. Unfortunately, it all backfired when Boris had trouble remembering who had given him an extra £58,000 to put towards the refurb. Many people shrugged, and the poll showed that Boris's brand of Bullingdon boy bungling still resonated strongly with voters, who remembered the grim alternative presented to them at the last election. Jeremy Corbyn promising a fairer society and free broadband in a cardigan. The general public's indifference to our glorious leader's casual attitude to accepting money from strangers, coupled with his callous disregard for human life, made me realise there are two types of voter in the UK. The rational voter, able to weigh up facts and arrive at conclusions based on evidence, and the people who are happy to inhale Boris Johnson's cheese farts and pretend they smell of roses. Local elections are looming in England, Scotland and Wales, and as a low-ranking management drone working for a Conservative council, I have to follow the recommended code of practice during purdah, which means I should not issue any publicity which seeks to influence voters. So I will try not to influence how you vote. But the time is coming when the ballot paper will be in your hand, and you're going to have to ask yourself the question, are you a fart inhaler? There was good news too for people from minority ethnic backgrounds in the UK when they woke up to discover they lived in the least racist country in the world. The report of the Commission on Race and Ethnic Disparities was published on the 31st of March and was met with immediate accusations of cherry-picking evidence to fit the government's narrative that the structural racism identified in four previous reports since 2017 has gone away of its own accord, and that the best solution is some kind of cheery optimism that everything will work out fine if we just stop indulging in identity politics and Black Lives Matter's victimhood agenda. This was exemplified in sentences such as, "There is a new story about the Caribbean experience, which speaks to the slave period not only being about profit and suffering, but how culturally African people transform themselves into a remodeled African/Briton." And maybe there is a new story about the slave period. But it could be argued that here in Britain, we haven't quite grasped the plot of the old story about the slave period, with statues still celebrating the selfless philanthropy of Tory slave merchants, while conveniently failing to mention the death, dehumanisation and industrial exploitation of African people, and the vast generational wealth still enjoyed by descendants of slavers, largely due to the British government borrowing 40% of its national budget to pay compensation to slave-owning families when slavery was abolished in 1833. A debt we only finished repaying in 2015. Taxpayers will be relieved to know that no reparations were made to slaves or descendants of slaves. Although the report was condemned by the UN Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent as reprehensible for its mythical representation of enslavement and for implying that racism exists largely in the imagination of black people, it is more nuanced than a one-hour show dedicated to the satirical dismantling of Tory hypocrisy allows us to explore. It identifies that socio-economic factors are often bigger obstacles to equality than race alone, and concludes what this country needs is not a race war, but a class war. The arguments over the report will no doubt rumble on, but I think everyone can agree that the UK became demonstrably less racist on the 9th of April, when Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh, sadly passed away. Rooksook by Kraftwerk, the opening track from their self-titled debut album released in 1970, played in memory of founder member Florian Schneider, who died in April last year. Normally after the death of an undocumented migrant, Priti Patel would arrange for all witnesses to be deported, so it was a relief to see the royal family in front of the cameras paying tribute to the Duke in the 24/7 rolling coverage that followed the announcement of his death. But not all viewers shared my relief. In fact, 110,000 people had the audacity to complain to the BBC that there was too much royal coverage on the telly. Many were understandably furious that the BBC rescheduled the final of MasterChef, and viewers were denied the chance to watch Greg Wallace leer at a Bakewell tart. People weren't just upset about missing MasterChef. Some were shocked by the sudden reappearance of Prince Andrew, the Duke of York, who surfaced from hiding without so much as a trigger warning to give interviews to the BBC. Prince Andrew, or Randy Andy, the Playboy Prince, as the press used to call him when I was a lad. They couldn't exactly call him Rappy Andy, the b***er prince, could they? That's still unproved, and would therefore be libelous, even though it is certainly true. Prince Randy Andy had no doubt calculated that this would be the perfect time to re-emerge, as surely no one would be so disrespectful and insensitive they would mention child sex trafficking allegations and his refusal to speak to the FBI when he was mourning the death of his father. The Playboy Prince remained in the news when it was reported that he'd asked his mum if he could wear an admiral costume to his dad's funeral. He became a fake vice admiral on his 55th birthday and was due an automatic promotion to fake admiral on his 60th. But he chose to defer the honour until people had forgotten about his widely documented friendship with convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein and the ongoing investigations into the trafficking of a minor for sex with a prince at Epstein's house in Belgravia and on his private island, Little St. James, in the ironically named Virgin Islands. While researching Little St. James, I found an article in Film Daily that said that the island's nickname, Paedophile Island, was, quote, a giant red flag. The minor in question, Virginia Roberts Giffray, was allegedly introduced to Prince Andrew by Ghislaine Maxwell in London, who told her, "Today you're going to meet a prince." Now I'm not sure what romantic image this conjured up in young Virginia's mind. Maybe something from Disney's Cinderella. Unfortunately, although this story had a happy ending, it wasn't the type you get in a fairy tale. It was the happy ending men get in an unlicensed massage parlour. Anyway, I digress. Randy Andy, the Playboy Prince, he wanted to wear an admiral costume to the funeral. He may not be a real admiral, or even a real vice admiral, but he did serve in the Navy and saw action of a sort in the Falklands conflict. That's where an overdose of adrenaline from being a war hero left him with a unique medical condition, his inability to sweat. So the sweaty prince Virginia Roberts Giffray danced with in Tramp Nightclub must have been someone else. His remarkable medical condition aroused much ridicule on the socials at the time of his interview with Emily Maitlis. But remember, you need to have sweat glands and an endothermic metabolism to sweat. Whereas Prince Andrew basks in the sun to raise his body temperature before scurrying forth in search of prey. And when he becomes too hot, he crawls under a rock to cool down in the shade. For some people, Prince Andrew's sudden reappearance on TV was about as welcome as finding Gary Glitter half-submerged in a soft play ball pit. Or Randy Gary, the Playboy pop star, as the papers used to call him when I was a lad. Anyway, I keep digressing. Luckily for Prince Andrew, no one was disrespectful enough to mention the alleged statutory rape of a minor while he was feeling sad. And, to avoid upsetting Harry, no one was allowed to attend the funeral in fancy dress. Unfortunately, this message did not get to the Queen, and she turned up as sorrow.
One lonely evening alone home, end up with carpal tunnel syndrome. Here I am, known for giving heavy backaches, grown and living off a little Debbie snack cakes. Wait, supposed to be checking emails. All I got is messages from ass-necked females. Okay. I don't know no Jenny. She said it's free and I won't owe her a penny. And that's the last time I saw her. But thousands of more horrors on online Gomorrah. Inside them, they got them with their curls out. And they got a better sales pitch than the Girl Scouts. I wonder what I owe her for a whole box of caramel coconut Samoa. Okay, honey, sweet dreams. Now it gets very serious like pink creams. A metal hand feels squished on the quilt. Mrs. wakes up and I'm killed over spilled milk. Locked in, looking at your picture. Fully clothed winter and I'm right there with ya. Thinking about the last time I split your wishbone. A man could only wish you do the same till he get home. Fat chance, at least he got snacks. Gotta have to do till a brother get back. Until then, smack one eye jack. And I hope one of his peoples could hook him with a tri-pack. That's three different flavors, chocolate, vanilla, and strawberry wafers. He acting all hard, about to get beat up. I'll show him what time it is once I get this sheet up. Soon as he fell off the beat down, all I hear is
13 cell, put the sheet down.
Damn, CO, what the hell does she know? Besides the fact she wanna back dug out on a D-Lo. A workaholic with a fountain and an ink pen. House in the mountains and he stopped drinking again. In the wee hours, he's gotten farther. Needing three showers, being hot and bothered. The Wiz with her leg bent, pregnant. God bless the day she wondered where her egg went. He got the L, but it's hard to drink without it. Hank can use some cookies, but try not to think about it. Watching Bet on Jabs for knowledge on file. Every other commercial, college hoes gone wild. Soft batch, he prefer the other bunch like they got for lunch. Chocolate fudge, butter crunch. Don't mess with the Ritz bits, no. Weekends, saltines, and Triscuits.
No.
Matzos and Cheez-Its, cat sugar fits every time you see a nice pair of Chips Ahoy, double chocolate chunk, something with the bubble and the junk in the trunk. Even the Oreo, no matter what the weather, always kept it dipped in milk and stuck together. In the game, he's shameless, even uses a code name, Famous Amos. Cheaper than a short stay at the Days Inn and good like 25-cent oatmeal raisin. Give it up to who invented the camera, never mind the gingerbread man or the grandmas. Make sure she don't wake from a dream chill or get caught with a handful of cream filled.
Cookie!
It might seem ill.
Wash your hands!
The cookies.
Oh, cookies!
We shall now vote for a new world leader. I nominate Doom. All in favor, say aye.
Aye!
Oh, no.
Doom is master of the world.
I'd sure hate to see that ugly mug of yours in my history book.
You've disturbed me for the last time.
Hey, you know something, gang? That Doom ain't really all bad. Between you and me, I kind of like being black.
Well, maybe if we're lucky, he'll attack us once more and send you back, Benjamin.
Very funny. Very, very funny.
He must be mad.
No, if anyone can do it. Nevertheless, let's get out of here while we can.
Food. MF Doom with Cookies from the Food album released in 2004. That went out to everyone who was shocked and saddened by the sudden postponement of MasterChef on the 9th of April. And of course, everyone who was shocked and saddened by the death of MF Doom, who died in October last year. Well, we're nearly at the end of the show. At this point, I would normally refer back to something I said near the start of the show. In proper comedy, this would be a callback. You'll remember I said in the introduction that Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh, was worshipped as a god and revered by subjects of the Commonwealth. This is apparently true. On the southern island of Tanna in Vanuatu, where the Kastam people created a cargo cult dedicated to the veneration of Prince Philip as a deity, the divine descendant of a volcano god. Imagine how the Kastam people felt on the 9th of April, when they discovered they can't watch MasterChef, and God is dead. So let's take a moment at the end of the show to spare a thought for the indigenous population of this tiny backward island, cut off from the world by sea and left behind by the march of time, for whom the death of Prince Philip is far more significant than the death of many thousands of normal human beings. As these simple folk mourn his passing with their primitive customs, unchanged since the 1950s. with processions, flowers, photos, little flags, and commemorative plates, blissfully unaware that the Philip they revere is no more or less worthy of celebration than any other person on that tiny, insignificant island. And to play us out, in a change from the musical theme of the show, we have the Bulvanua local string band with Naja. They're not from the island I've been talking about, but they are from Vanuatu, where there are loads of great string bands waiting for you to discover on YouTube. That's it for this month. Normal service resumes on the 31st of May. Thanks very much for listening. Thank you.